South Florida has a stake in the Epstein files, too. The Freedom Tower turns 100, but are Cubans celebrating? And goodbye Gramps, but hello Churchills. Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, whether or not that really is Donald Trump's signature, we'll examine all the still unanswered questions in the Epstein sex trafficking atrocity that still traumatizes South Florida. We'll also look at next week's centennial reopening of Miami's Freedom Tower, but also at why Miami's Cubans may be feeling more ambivalent than exultant at the ribbon cutting. And we'll say farewell to one popular hip music venue, but welcome back to another. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or on WLRN.org. This week, Democrats on the House Oversight Committee released a birthday letter purportedly sent by Donald Trump in 2003 to his then-buddy Jeffrey Epstein, who 16 years later would be arrested on federal charges of sex trafficking girls and then kill himself in his jail cell. President Trump denies sending the letter, which bears the drawing of a female body and Trump's signature, which the president also denies. Either way, it has intensified calls for Congress to release the so-called Epstein files. But we perhaps too often forget that the Epstein case is as much about South Florida as Washington, D.C. So much of the ghastly trafficking Epstein committed was focused here, and so were the prosecutorial scandals involved in the lenient treatment Epstein received for so many years until his federal arrest in 2019. Trump's purported letter to Epstein and last week's gathering of Epstein victims on Capitol Hill have given new impetus to answering the raft of important questions still hanging over this atrocity. Joining me now is Steve Bousquet, opinion editor at the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, which this week published an editorial demanding those answers. Steve, thanks as always for coming on.
Yes, thanks, Tim.
I just want to start by asking you up front what you and the Sun-Sentinel editorial board feel are the most important, if not the most troubling, questions still unanswered in the Epstein case.
Sure. Well, we tried our best to frame that question and get our readers thinking about all of the many unanswered questions about the Epstein scandal. If I could just give a 30,000-foot view of that answer, it is, how did this guy get away with such horrendous criminal activity for so long? Who was protecting him? What did he have on other people? It appears, as this story goes on and on, Tim, Epstein seemed to have protectors everywhere.
Yeah.
And that is at the root, I think, of why America has such a longing to get for the media and others to get to the bottom of what happened here.
So when we talk about the South Florida connection to the Epstein monstrosity, one of the most troubling facets is the years of prosecutorial kid glove treatment Epstein received. And that spotlight falls on the then U.S. attorney in Miami, Alex Acosta, and the Palm Beach State Attorney's Office, who, as your editorial argues, ended up giving Epstein a, quote, slap on the wrist back in the 2000s. What still has yet to be explained or held accountable when it comes to their role?
I think that in piecing this together way after the fact, you know, it's a question of finding out who was in the room, who signed off on this. Since Alex Acosta was running the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami at the time, we're left to think that this couldn't have possibly happened without a sign off from somebody at the Department of Justice in Washington. And who were those people? As we all know, the trail begins to get of time, and time is passing here. That's why it's an encouraging sign, I think, to see Congress trying to maneuver here and call for a special vote to release these files.
The Sun-Sentinel editorial points out that Epstein's sex trafficking henchwoman, Ghislaine Maxwell, who's now serving 20 years, has argued in her appeal that she should have received the same prosecutorial deference that Epstein received early on. Does she have a point?
Well, I guess she has a point from a standpoint of, legal as a legal defense point, yes. But as a matter of public policy and the horrible circumstances that surround all these young women, no. Maxwell appears to have gotten what she deserves, but I can't blame her for trying to use every possible argument to get out of prison.
The editorial also rightly applauds the investigative work that Miami Herald reporter Julie K. Brown did that exposed that prosecutorial conduct and compelled federal prosecutors in New York then to pursue Epstein for his sexual abuse of girls both there and in Palm Beach. Since Epstein has been dead 6 years now, does the groundwork that Brown's journalism laid in this case seem to call out for the release of grand jury and other information that's believed to be contained in those so-called Epstein files to get to the bottom of issues like, for example, who his accomplices might have been, as you just mentioned earlier?
Absolutely. I think there's, despite the outstanding journalistic work of Julie K. Brown, there's still a lot we don't know here. To her great efforts and persistence that have kept this thing in the news all this time, Donald Trump does not want this story to be on the front page or on newscasts day after day. There are always other terrible, important news stories that are happening in this country all the time. But, you know, this is a story with immense staying power.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to mention that in the American psyche, in the American impulse, there's a strong, deeply ingrained feeling that if you have enough money and enough connections, you can get special treatment no matter how bad the crime you've committed. And that's what's at the root of this whole thing.
Yeah.
Yes, pedophilia. And now, as we said, now in the New York Times expose this week, showing how executives at the J.P. Morgan Bank went out of their way to protect Epstein. If I could just very briefly just quote from the New York Times piece.
Sure.
Which is kind of what this discussion's about. Mysteries continue to swirl around how Epstein amassed and deployed money and influence on a grand scale. That's what this is about. This is an incredible tale of the use of money and influence to cover up horrendous crimes in the United States.
As I mentioned, last week, dozens of Epstein's victims were in Washington calling for the release of the Epstein files. Do you think their appearance there helped prod the release of the alleged Donald Trump birthday letter to Epstein we mentioned at the outset? And if so, does that bode well for the release of further information? I mean, the Sun Sentinel editorial, for example, mentioned the possibility of a so-called discharge petition that could force a vote in the House, even if Republican Speaker Mike Johnson opposes it.
Right. I think that discharge position that might indeed get to the finish line over Johnson's objection. My understanding is a majority of members can vote to have that done. It's refreshing. It's incredibly refreshing and surprising that discharge petition has bipartisan support. The two members of Congress who organized the Epstein victims on the steps of the U.S. Capitol were Ro Khanna, a Democrat from California, and Thomas Massie, Republican from Kentucky, who's a big thorn in the side of the MAGA crowd. Anyway, he's been pushing for the release of this information as well. The victims need to keep, and their families need to keep speaking out. It will keep the momentum going on this story for a long, long time.
Staying on the subject of those victims themselves, one of the most vocal of whom, Virginia Giuffre, died by suicide earlier this year. Can we step back a second and just remind people of the human trauma involved in this case, Steve, and the effect it's had on the South Florida community where so much of it played out?
Of course, yes. It's been horrifying. That is one of the most stunning and impressive aspects of Julie Brown's reporting about the Epstein case, is that she was able to gain the trust of the victims, who are, you know, who have tried, I'm sure without success, to move on with their lives as best they can. You mentioned at the very outset an important point. This is a local news story for us in South Florida.
Yeah.
The federal prosecutor is in Miami. The state prosecutor is in West Palm Beach. The crimes occurred in Palm Beach County, and on and on.
Are we seeing, though, repercussions of that, I guess I would ask as a follow-up, in terms of, you know, we've seen other cases recently of sexual abuse, you know, here in Miami. Do you think that this case has made our local South Florida prosecutorial infrastructure, let's say, take these cases more seriously?
I would hope so. I'm not entirely convinced of that yet. I think the criminal justice system, it's another conversation for us to have, but I think the criminal justice system locally, especially in South Florida, is overwhelmed. It is habitually understaffed, underfinanced, but I think that the Epstein case has kept pedophilia and sexual abuse much more prominently in the public consciousness, and I wish and hope that that includes people in the criminal justice system as well.
Yeah.
You know, there are people, this is an amazing situation. I see this on social media. There are people who are not convinced that Epstein is dead.
Yeah.
The Department of Justice has said he's deceased. He's been dead for 6 years. But that even that is takes an enormous effort to convince people of the truthfulness of that fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of conspiracy swirling around all of this. This is why, I guess, finally, Steve, I think we have to end where I started, which is with President Trump and all the questions now arising again about his friendship and then falling out with Epstein back in those days. His own South Florida base here, Mar-a-Lago, was once an Epstein stomping ground. But how deep is the political trouble attached to this controversy? And as we mentioned, all of the conspiracy theories swirling around it, how deep is that political trouble getting for the president now, in your view?
I think it's pretty serious. But again, Trump, you know, Trump has 1,000 lives. You know, he seems sometimes impenetrable, to impervious to this kind of criticism. I think what's going to happen is we're inching our way ever closer to the reality of the 2026 election cycle. You have Republicans running in competitive districts. You know, that is the next, twist in this saga, where people who otherwise would be strong Trump supporters are going to have to face the music and ask about whether or not, you know, Trump needs to explain more of his behavior. Though it's a cliche, you know, in this case, a picture really is worth 1,000 words. Those many, many photographs of Trump socializing, you know, joyously having his arm draped around Jeffrey Epstein, those pictures are not going away.
Yeah. Well, then finally, this week we saw another political casualty. Britain's ambassador to the U.S., Peter Mandelson, was fired because of his own close ties to Epstein. Do you think we're likely to see more of that kind of thing as we move forward here, Steve?
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. I think that if it's, if this story has the momentum and the ability to reach across the Atlantic Ocean to cause serious, you know, political repercussions over there, then it's likely to take down somebody else in this country as well. I don't know who, but again, it's a story that seems to have no end. We live in a time when people are wringing their hands and bemoaning the death or dying of the mainstream media, but it is the mainstream media that deserves the recognition for everything that's come out about Epstein and hopefully will continue to come out in the weeks and months ahead.
Steve Bousquet is the opinion editor of the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Steve, thanks as always.
Okay, Tim. Good talking with you.
Still to come, Miami's renovated Freedom Tower reopens next week, but will the Cuban celebration be muted? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. Next Tuesday, Miami's iconic downtown Freedom Tower turns 100, and after a two-year, $30 million renovation led by Miami-Dade College, it will reopen as a reimagined community engagement and cultural center. The Freedom Tower, of course, is best known as the Ellis Island of Miami, the place where hundreds of thousands of Cuban exiles were processed for immigration to the U.S. In many ways, it's their Statue of Liberty. But that's precisely why next week's ribbon cutting is taking place under a certain cloud for many Cubans. The community that once enjoyed special immigration privileges here has watched that welcome mat disappear in recent years, but especially this year under the second Trump administration. That's a particularly hard reality to swallow, since a significant majority of Cubans in Miami-Dade County voted for President Trump. As a result, the Freedom Tower Centennial feels fraught as well as festive. Joining me now to examine those mixed emotions is Michael Bustamante. He himself is a Cuban-American, as well as a history professor and Cuban studies expert at the University of Miami. Michael, thanks for talking with us.
Good to be with you again, Tim.
You apparently got an early look at the newly renovated Freedom Tower recently, and you said it was pretty impressive. Tell us what you saw and what stood out for you, especially in terms of this new community engagement role it looks ready to play.
Sure. Well, first and foremost, I think Miami-Dade College has completed a magnificent renovation of a really important architectural landmark in the city. Nothing else. So I think visitors will experience that beauty and see the building as it was first sort of envisioned once again. And of course, the Freedom Tower was not only the home of the Cuban refugee program in the 1960s, it had a life prior to that. It was the home of the Miami News. And so some of the exhibitions kind of reflect that early history. But I think certainly it's no surprise, given the significance of the Freedom Tower for the Cuban community, that one of the highlights of this sort of new museum type experience are the galleries that relate to that history. And, the curators and team over there have worked with a number of community partners in town to assemble a really, I think, powerful, interactive series of exhibitions, mm-hmm. Interactive displays where you can listen to hundreds of oral history interviews, maps of where people were relocated in the United States with the help of the refugee program. And I think probably most powerfully for folks, there's a kind of two-period recreation of sort of the main entrance hall of the Freedom Tower from its time as the head of the headquarters of the Cuban refugee program. And it's mm-hmm. difficult to not walk in there and feel moved by it.
So, Michael, remind us just how important the Freedom Tower was, especially in the 1960s and 70s, in terms of ushering in the Cuban exile community, including you're a family, I imagine, that did so much, the community that did so much to make modern Miami.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when the Cuban refugee program was really a kind of a hallmark of, in a sense, and perhaps somewhat ironically, kind of big government stepping in and responding to a real need, the need of, thousands of folks who were fleeing Cuba in the wake of the Cuban Revolution. The Cuban refugee program itself gets started in 1960, first on a kind of a temporary basis, when in fact city leaders in Miami say to the federal government, hey, we need some help to sort of help deal with this new influx of migrants.
Right. And
then it's relocated to the Freedom Tower in 1962. So it, over the life of the Cuban refugee program, something on the order of $2 billion in aid was essentially injected into South Florida. That was, wow. Cash assistance, food, job placement, resettlement programs. It really helped provide, I think, a softer landing than might have been the experience otherwise for Cubans arriving in very mm-hmm. difficult circumstances, which is not to say it was easy, but certainly the program kind of undergirded the rise of the mm-hmm. Cuban-American community in a really big way.
And of course, a lot of that had to do with measures like the Cuban Adjustment Act of 1966 that admittedly gave Cuban exiles a more open door to the U.S. than perhaps other immigrant groups enjoyed. How would you describe the immigration expectation, that default feeling of welcome that Cubans would then go on to experience in the decades ahead?
Well, I don't think it was entirely clear, from the beginning. The U.S. government definitely did make a conscious decision in the early 1960s that they were going to sort of open doors for Cubans who were leaving. Mm-hmm. Most Cubans who arrived in the early 1960s, actually the vast majority, came in under the presidential parole authority. That has been the subject of much controversy and discussion in recent years.
Right.
Folks did not arrive with anything like a formal refugee visa like exists today. That didn't really exist at the time in the same way. And so, for a while, folks were coming and the U.S. government said, we're going to let you stay. But everyone had the expectation also that they'd be going back very quickly.
Right.
So the Adjustment Act, once it's passed in 1966 and provides that sort of accelerated path to permanent residency for Cubans going forward, it does set that expectation, I think, for many generations of Cubans that, mm-hmm. If all else fails, I have a pathway ahead. It was not a perfect story. The Mariel Boatlift, there were people who were deemed excludable from entrance. The Balsero crisis is another moment where the ability of Cubans to enter the country is in doubt for a moment. Right.
The Balsero crisis being the rafters. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Exactly. In 1994, and they were sent to the Guantanamo base until their status was litigated. So, you know, little by little, that sort of special pathway has eroded. But 2017 was the bigger moment.
Yeah,
speaking of
that erosion, toward the end of the Obama administration, then about a decade ago, that began to change. Cuban immigration privileges, like the so-called wet foot, dry foot arrangement, started to fall away. Even the Cuban Adjustment Act accommodations that Cubans had long taken for granted eventually started to feel much less automatic than in the past under both the first Trump administration and then the Biden administration. Why do you think that all began to become the case, Michael?
Well, it's interesting. The Obama administration gets rid of wet foot, dry foot literally in its last week in office, sort of as it was on its way out the door. And it was kind of the last piece of its policy of normalization with Cuba at the time. And, you know, from the logic of that policy, whether you're in favor or against it, it stands to reason. If you're normalizing your relationship with the country's government, a special immigration policy for that country's nationals doesn't really make sense.
Yeah.
And so it was eliminated. But in an interesting way, as much as there was outcry when it was eliminated, folks on the other side of the aisle have certainly not mobilized to put it back in place. So it's a before and after moment in a big way. The Cuban Adjustment Act is still in force, but essentially what's happened is that it's become the channels for accessing it are more difficult because you have to be legally admitted into the United States to be able to qualify. And that's really what's changed since the first Trump administration.
But why does that feeling of lost immigration privilege feel so much more acute at this moment under the second Trump administration? We can point, for example, to moves this year, such as canceling humanitarian parole for Cuban migrants, as well as Venezuelans, Haitians, and Nicaraguans, of course. But why does the Cuban community seem to feel more betrayed right now than it perhaps did before this year?
Well, I think the degree of that betrayal depends on, or that feeling of betrayal depends on what sector of the community you're talking to. And there's a robust debate happening right now in the community about the future of U.S. immigration policy toward Cubans, let alone in general.
Yeah.
But I think that the fraughtness of this moment has to do in particular with the fact that Cuba has just experienced its largest out-migration in history.
Yeah.
If between 1959 and 73, half a million Cubans left, in the last 5 years, more than a million have. It's the largest migration in terms of absolute numbers and percentage of the population ever.
Yeah,
and
a tenth of the population on the island, right?
Exactly, if not more.
Yeah.
And while a large number of those folks through parole and other programs and the Adjustment Act have been able to access permanent status, there's about 400,000 to 500,000 people, which is the same number of people who were processed in the Freedom Tower back in the day, who are in limbo. And so, you know, the question I think some are asking and that the re-inauguration of the Freedom Tower poses is why a Cuban refugee program then? Why not something like that now? Why not something like that now for other migrant communities who have come in great numbers in recent years?
Mm-hmm. No, that's an interesting question, but does it sting more, Michael, because Cuban voters here so strongly supported President Trump in last year's election?
I think in part, I think for some. I think, you know, as news has trickled out in recent weeks of some of these recently arrived Cubans who are being detained by immigration authorities, some of their families who sponsored their relatives to get out have said, you know, we voted for the president and we didn't think that he was going to target our community necessarily. But I also think there's a robust debate. I think there's another part of the Cuban American community that has started to arrive at a different conclusion, which is that, you know, Cuba's problems are never going to be solved if everyone continues to leave.
Yeah.
And yet I think it's a very hard thing to talk about, you know, perhaps closing the door that you or your relatives came in through. But that's effectively the conversation that's happening in the community. And it's a very it's not an easy one.
Does a lot of it have to do with perhaps an intangible loss of status or prestige? Is it a blow to the Cuban community, for example, to feel as though their immigrants are suddenly viewed as contemptuously by the federal immigration apparatus as, say, undocumented Central American farm workers? Does it perhaps sting the Cuban community more to hear their immigrants derided as, quote, illegal aliens the way others have for so long?
I think in part, and I think that's the tension that's in play. I mean, again, I think there are some who have arrived at the conclusion that continuous mass migration from Cuba is not going to solve Cuba's problems. But there is a kind of a concern about sort of the uniqueness of the Cuban story somehow perhaps being lost, right?
Right.
And that I think is really what's at stake in this moment for so many.
And speaking of the Freedom Tower itself, I then also wanted to ask if optics matter when we consider why next week's centennial celebration of the Freedom Tower might be a somewhat uncomfortable moment for Cubans right now. I mean, in those earlier days, the door Cubans came through was that Miami Statue of Liberty, the Freedom Tower. There was a certain dignity built into that image. So much of today's Cuban immigration, in contrast, is coming over the U.S. southern border, like those Central American laborers. Does that render a psychological effect that we're also witnessing right now, Michael?
Maybe for some, though, you know, I think if you follow the reporting, some of the really wonderful reporting that's been done by people like Carla Gloria Colomé for El País about Cuban migration today, there's a lot of dignity in the incredible stories of people who have gone through just incredible things to get to this country.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to not lose that. And you know, the Freedom Tower as a symbol, again, I think it raises that question about contemporary migration. You know, what are the things that people are leaving Cuba for today really that different than they were, you know, 60 years ago? That is sort of, I think, the elephant in the room, perhaps, of an otherwise, you know, festive occasion and certainly a worthwhile one.
Michael, in just the 30 seconds we have left, looking ahead, does this have a silver lining, though, in the sense that it helps create more Cuban affinity or solidarity with other immigrant groups here, like those Central Americans and Haitians and Venezuelans, and perhaps more of the Miami community ethos that the renovated Freedom Tower is out to promote?
That's certainly my hope. I think the inauguration of the Freedom Tower, the reopening, I think presents the community with a choice. The community can decide that sort of its own refugee past is to be celebrated almost in amber, as if it doesn't have much bearing on the present. Or this can be a call to action, a call to sort of see ourselves, our parents, our grandparents in the struggles of people today.
Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. Well, when it comes to Miami's alternative music scene, we've got good news and bad news. First, the bad news, or at least what I quickly discovered was bad news when I saw all the long faces and mournful Slack messages among our younger staff here at WLRN a couple weeks ago. Gramps will be closing for good in January, after 13 years as one of the most popular bars and live music gathering spots in Wynwood, a venue that gave folks everything from pop to metal to drag. But the good news. The legendary and gritty dive bar in Little Haiti known as Churchill's Pub, which opened in 1979 but shut down 5 years ago amid the COVID pandemic, has now reopened. Famous for having hosted acts like Iggy Pop and Marilyn Manson, it's still the place for underground punk, metal, and moshing. And its rebirth coincides with the reopening of another local alternative favorite, Las Rosas in Wynwood. Joining me now in the studio to discuss all this Miami music news are two of our WLRN reporters who follow this scene very closely, digital producer Elisa Ramos, who also writes our weekly arts newsletter, The AC, and morning host Natu Twe, who is also our resident mosh pit maestro. How are you guys?
All right.
Doing good.
Okay, Natu, let's start with the news that Gramps has only a few months left in Wynwood.
Yes.
Why is it closing, and why is its closing such a bummer for music fans here?
Yeah, well, Tim, on August 28th, Gramps posted a video on Instagram with the owner, Adam Gerson, and he was saying, you know, they're closing the first week of January 2026, and he said the time to leave Wynwood has come. There wasn't really a distinct, as far as I can remember, issue with rent, rising costs, money, which is, at this time in Miami and South Florida, is kind of expected in some places. He said they still have a great relationship with the man who got them their space, Ari Dispenza of Central Commercial Realty. And it is a bummer. Gramps has cemented itself as a prominent venue and area in Wynwood that's open to many things.
So if you got all that going for you, why close down?
You know, some of my friends, people in my circle, they're wondering, like, maybe is there something that isn't? But also, I don't think it's far-fetched to say maybe it's time to come, right? Gramps has Gramps Getaway on the Rickenbacker, going to keep a scan.
Uh-huh.
And people have, I've heard a lot of people, from older, younger people saying, Wynwood now isn't what it was 10, 13 years ago when Gramps opened. And they say maybe it's just foot traffic in some places.
And just really quickly, why was it so important during those 13 years? Or not only important, but so popular during those 13 years?
It's just everything. You know, everything. It housed a lot under that outdoor tiki decor, right?
Yeah.
I think of John McHale, who runs Break Even Booking, right? It's a booking agency he's been running for over 20 years. He's a fixture in the scene, and he came to Gramps, I believe, a few years ago or so, and the spotlight he put on the region and Gramps on the map for the shows, all the legacy hardcore punk rock bands, you know, having someone like that who cares about the scene and music brings people in.
Yeah. Alyssa, what about you? Why do you feel Gramps's imminent departure is such a blow?
For me, it feels significant in particular because it felt like the last man standing. You know, it was one of those few places that survived you know, Wynwood's changing landscape. One of the few places that didn't feel like it was overrun by like high-end restaurants and condos. And for me personally, it was one of the few reasons I wanted to go to Wynwood. Gramps truly had interesting programming, and they uplifted local groups. You know, it hosted film screenings, comedy shows, drag, poetry nights. And this is key, it was relatively affordable and you could get good pizza.
What a good pizza.
Those are all great reasons. So why then, Alyssa, are we seeing Churchill's coming back in Little Haiti? And why is that such great news for music fans here?
It's not entirely clear why Churchill's decided to reopen now, but when I did talk to their comms person, they did tell me that it was just time to give Miami an outlet for underground music again.
Yeah.
You know, for context, you mentioned earlier the venue shuttered in 2020 at the start of the pandemic, and they underwent a contentious eviction battle between the owners and the manager. So 5 years later, they've really had time to reflect. But regardless, it's great news for music fans because it's a place to discover new and local bands, or just bands you wouldn't find anywhere else in Miami.
Right. Now, Alyssa, you report that Churchill's reopening last Saturday night saw folks drive in from all over Florida. And one of the bands that came back to play was Bruvvy, whose singer, Liz Verum, first performed at Churchill 7 years ago. Let's listen to a little bit of what she told you.
The Miami music scene is not limited to the venues that we get to play or the studios we get to record at. The Miami scene lives in the hearts and souls and like the minds and imaginations of the kids that live in Miami. There's a will, there's a way, you know, and if Gramps is shutting down, then we'll play somewhere else.
So, Alyssa, how important is Churchill's to that grassroots underground Miami music culture Liz was just describing there? You mentioned in your report this week, for example, that Churchill's is often referred to as the CBGB of Miami, a reference to the pioneering New York punk music club that came online in the 1970s, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, independent artists need to get their start somewhere, and Churchill's is that place. I mean, you mentioned a lot of big acts have performed there, from Marilyn Manson to Iggy Pop to the Mavericks, but, you know, everyone I talked to at the reopening, a lot of them said, we've played here before. We're coming back. I played here when I was 15, 16, you know, as part of a band. And, you know, it was a training ground for them to really learn how to perform. And I think, you know, with my reporting, a lot of people stress the importance of performing music live. That's how you cut your teeth. You know, with the rise of genres like bedroom pop and with social media and TikTok, there might be less of an incentive to perform live when you can get discovered on the internet or go viral. There are merits to both platforms for sure, but nothing beats a live performance.
No, I would agree with you. Natu Twe, let me ask you the same question. Why is Churchill's return such a shot in the arm for the alternative music scene here?
You know, establishments like Churchill's help foster the local scene and its community, right? It's a really big aspect. Like Alyssa said, you got a place to play, perform, a place that isn't looking at really your views, how many likes you got on something, looking at, which is why what the industry's kind of changed with the rise of TikTok and streaming services. Some places won't let you or want you to play depending on your credentials around that aspect. But with Churchill's, if you can play, prove yourself on the stage, and it really helps foster and let people grow in their bands. And also to say, to like what Liz said, you know, singer from Bruvvy, people in DIY in the underground scene will play where they can. I've been to shows, backyards, garages, a bank, right? Where there's a will, there definitely is a way, regardless.
Alyssa Ramos, your report on Churchill's reopening made the point that it, quote, coincides with a sea change in South Florida's music scene. How would you describe what's happening these days with the larger alternative music scene here? Is it evolving? And if so, how would you say?
It's hard to say how things are evolving right now because we're in it. You know, any culture will reflect the time that we're in. And while it's a little premature to determine, you know, what has changed or what is changing, I do think we're seeing more artists really embrace their vulnerability, you know, embrace their own narratives and express their political beliefs, especially now. You know, it's more charged right now with our political environment and what younger generations are experiencing right now. So I think we're going to see that in the music that we hear.
Natu Tway, you're a scholar of sorts when it comes to the Miami and Florida music scene. And you mentioned to me earlier that we need to look at events like Churchill's return and Gramps' goodbye on a larger as well as local scale. What, in just the minute we have left, is that larger picture you're talking about?
Well, Florida's a hotbed for music, right? I think of the Chitlin' Circuit after World War II, massive urban air in Florida, and black artists and musicians could tour from Jacksonville to Miami to Orlando and make a living. And the same could be applied to other scenes, DIY, underground, punk, emo. And you have a place that people can come to, a home, and make a living and get their name out. It's a vast state.
Yeah. Natu Tway is WLRN's morning host and resident underground music expert. Alyssa Ramos is WLRN's digital producer who writes the weekly arts newsletter, The AC. Many thanks to you both. I really appreciate it, and have fun
when you go back. Right.
And finally on the roundup, speaking about places to go in Miami, our congrats to the one Magic City restaurant that made this week's New York Times 2025 restaurant list. What the paper calls a sultry new Miami steakhouse, Sonny's Steakhouse in Little River. But seriously, New York Times, using sultry to describe something in Miami? How original. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado. WLRN.